most of their watts off the fishing authority, like anybody else. But that geothermal water, they pump that up to a heat exchanger. It's too salty to drink, so in the exchanger, it just heats up your standard Jersey tap water, which a lot of people figure isn't worth drinking anyway. Finally, they were approaching a wall of some kind. Bobby looked back. Shallow pools on the muddy concrete floor caught and reflected the limbs of the dwarf trees, the bare pale roots straggling down into makeshift tanks of hydroponic fluid.
Then they pump that into shrimp tanks and grow a lot of shrimp. Shrimp grow real fast in warm water. Then they pump it through pipes in the concrete up here to keep this place warm. That's what this level was for. To grow ponic amaranth, lettuce, things like that. Then they pump it out into the catfish tanks, and algae eat the shrimp shit. Catfish eat the algae, and it all goes around again. Or anyway, that was the idea. Chances are they didn't figure anybody'd go up on the roof and kick those Darius rotors over to make room for a mosque. And they didn't figure a lot of other changes either. So we wound up with this space. But you can still get you some damn good shrimp in the projects. Catfish, too.
They had arrived at the wall. It was made of glass, beaded heavily with condensation. A few centimeters beyond it was another wall, that one made of what looked like rusty sheet steel. Beauvoir fished a key of some kind from a pocket in his sharkskin robe and slid it into an opening in a bare alloy beam dividing two expanses of window. Somewhere nearby, an engine whined into life. The broad steel shutter rotated up and out, moving jerkily, to reveal a view that Bobby had often imagined. They must be near the top, high up in the projects, because Big Playground was something he could cover with two hands. The condos of Barrytown looked like some gray-white fungus spreading to the horizon. It was nearly dark, and he could make out a pink glow beyond the last range of condo racks.
That's the sprawl over there, isn't it? That pink.
That's right. But the closer you get, the less pretty it looks. How'd you like to go there, Bobby? Count Zero ready to make the sprawl?
Oh, yeah,
Bobby said, his palms against the sweating glass.
You got no idea.
The derm had worn off entirely now, and his back and chest hurt like hell. Chapter 14. Night Flight. As the night came on, Turner found the edge again. It seemed like a long time since he'd been there, but when it clicked in, it was like he'd never left. It was that superhuman synchromesh flow that stimulants only approximated. He could only score for it on the site of a major defection, one where he was in command, and then only in the final hours before the actual move. But it had been a long time. In New Delhi, he'd only been checking out possible escape routes for an executive who wasn't entirely certain that relocation was what he wanted. If he had been working the edge that night in Chandani Chowk, maybe he'd have been able to dodge the thing. Probably not. But the edge would have told him to try. Now the edge let him collate the factors he had to deal with at the site, balancing clusters of small problems against single larger ones. So far there were a lot of little ones, but no real ball breakers. Lynch and Weber were starting to get in each other's hair. so he arranged to keep them apart. His conviction that Lynch was Conroy's plant, instinctive from the beginning, was stronger now. Instinct sharpened on the edge. Things got witchy. Nathan was having trouble with the low-tech Swedish hand warmers. Anything short of an electronic circuit baffled him. Turner put Lynch to work on the hand warmers, fueling and priming them, and let Nathan carry them out, two at a time, and bury them shallowly, at meter intervals, along the two long lines of orange tape. The Microsoft Conroy had sent filled his head with its own universe of constantly shifting factors. Airspeed, altitude, attitude, angle of attack, G-forces, headings. The plane's weapon delivery information was a constant subliminal litany of target designators, bomb fall lines, search circles, range and release cues, weapons counts. Conroy had tagged the Microsoft with a simple message outlining the plane's time of arrival and confirming the arrangement for space for a single passenger. He wondered what Mitchell was doing, feeling. The Moss Biolabs North America facility was carved into the heart of a sheer mesa, a table of rock thrusting from the desert floor. The Biosoft dossier had shown Turner the mesa's face, cut with bright evening windows. It wrote about the uplifted arms of a sea of saguaros, like the wheelhouse of a giant ship. To Mitchell, it had been prison and fortress, his home for 9 years. Somewhere near its core, he had perfected the hybridoma techniques that had eluded other researchers for almost a century. Working with human cancer cells and a neglected, nearly forgotten model of DNA synthesis, he had produced the immortal hybrid cells that were the basic production tools of the new technology. Minute biochemical factories, endlessly reproducing the engineered molecules that were linked and built up into biochips. Somewhere in the Moss arcology, Mitchell would be moving through his last hours as their star researcher. Turner tried to imagine Mitchell leading a very different sort of life following his defection to Osaka, but found it difficult. Was a research arcology in Arizona very different from one in Honshu? There had been times during that long day when Mitchell's coded memories had risen in him, filling him with a strange dread that seemed to have nothing to do with the operation at hand. It was the intimacy of the thing that still disturbed him, and perhaps the feeling of fear sprang from that. Certain fragments seemed to have an emotional power entirely out of proportion to their content. Why should a memory of a plain hallway in some dingy Cambridge graduate dormitory fill him with a sense of guilt and self-loathing? Other images, which logically should have carried a degree of feeling, were strangely lacking in affect. Mitchell playing with his baby daughter on an expanse of pale woolen broadloom in a rented house in Geneva. The child laughing, tugging at his hand. Nothing. The man's life, from Turner's vantage, seemed marked out by a certain inevitability. He was brilliant. A brilliance that had been detected early on, highly motivated, gifted at the kind of blandly ruthless in-company manipulation required by someone who aspired to become a top research scientist. If anyone was destined to rise through laboratory corporate hierarchies, Turner decided, it would be Mitchell. Turner himself was incapable of meshing with the intensely tribal world of the Zaibatsu men, the lifers. He was a perpetual outsider, a rogue factor adrift on the secret seas of intercorporate politics. No company man would have been capable of taking the initiatives Turner was required to take in the course of an extraction. No company man was capable of Turner's professionally casual ability to realign his loyalties to fit a change in employers. Or perhaps of his unyielding commitment once a contract had been agreed upon. He had drifted into security work in his late teens, when the grim doldrums of the post-war economy were giving way to the impetus of new technologies. He had done well in security, considering his general lack of ambition. He had a ropey, muscular poise that impressed his employer's clients. And he was bright, very bright. He wore clothes well. He had a way with technology. Conroy had found him in Mexico, where Turner's employer had contracted to provide security for a SenseNet Simpson team who were recording a series of 30-minute segments in an ongoing jungle adventure series. When Conroy arrived, Turner was finishing his arrangements. He'd set up a liaison between SenseNet and the local government, bribed the town's top police official, analyzed the hotel's security system, met the local guides and drivers and had their histories double-checked, arranged for digital voice protection on the SimSTEAM team's transceivers, established a crisis management team, and planted seismic sensors around the SenseNet suite cluster. He entered the hotel's bar, a jungle garden extension of the lobby, and found a seat by himself at one of the glass-topped tables. A pale man with a shock of white bleached hair crossed the bar with a drink in each hand. The pale skin was drawn tight across angular features and a high forehead. He wore a neatly pressed military shirt over jeans and leather sandals. "You're the security for those SimSTEAM kids," the pale man said, putting one of the drinks down on Turner's table. "Alfredo told me." Alfredo was one of the hotel bartenders. Turner looked up at the man, who was evidently sober and seemed to have all the confidence in the world. "I don't think we've been introduced," Turner said, making no move to accept the proffered drink. "Doesn't matter," Conroy said, seating himself. "We're in the same ball game." He seated himself. Turner stared. He had a bodyguard's presence, something restless and watchful written in the lines of his body. And few strangers would so casually violate his private space. "You know," the man said, "the way someone might comment on a team that wasn't doing particularly well in a given season, those seismics you're using really don't make it. I've met people who could walk in there, eat your kids for breakfast, stack the bones in the shower, and stroll out whistling. Those seismics would say it never happened." He took a sip of his drink. "You get A for effort, though. You know how to do a job." The phrase, "stack the bones in the shower," was enough. Turner decided to take the pale man out. "Look, Turner, here's your leading lady." The man smiled up at Jane Hamilton, who smiled back, her wide blue eyes clear and perfect. Each iris ringed with the minute gold lettering of the Zeiss icon logo. Turner froze, caught in a split-second lock of indecision. The star was close, too close, and the pale man was rising. "Nice meeting you, Turner," he said. "We'll get together, sooner or later. Take my advice about those seismics. Back them up with a perimeter of screamers." And then he turned and walked away, muscles rolling easily beneath the crisp fabric of his tan shirt.
"That's nice, Turner," Hamilton said, taking the stranger's place.
"Yeah?"
Turner watched as the man was lost in the confusion of the crowded lobby, amid pink-fleshed tourists.
You don't ever seem to talk to people. You always look like you're running a make on them, filing a report. It's nice to see you making friends for a change.
Turner looked at her. She was 20, 4 years his junior, and earned roughly 9 times his annual salary in a given week. She was blonde, her hair cropped short for the series role, deeply tanned, and looked as if she was illuminated from within by sun lamps. The blue eyes were inhumanly perfect optical instruments grown in vats in Japan. She was both actress and camera. Her eyes worth several million new yen, and in the hierarchy of Sense Net stars, she barely rated.
He sat with her in the bar until she'd finished 2 drinks, then walked her back to the sweet cluster.
You wouldn't feel like coming in for another, would you, Turner?
No, he said. This was the second evening she'd made the offer, and he sensed that it would be the last. I have to check the seismics. Later that night, he phoned New York for the number of a firm in Mexico City that could supply him with screamers for the perimeter of the sweet cluster. But a week later, Jane and 3 others, half the series cast, were dead.
We're ready to roll the medics, Weber said. Turner saw that she was wearing fingerless brown leather gloves. She'd replaced her sunglasses with clear glass shooting glasses, and there was a pistol on her hip. Sutcliffe's monitoring the perimeter with the remotes. We'll need everybody else to get the fucker through the brush.
Need me?
Ramirez says he can't do anything too strenuous this close to jacking in. You ask me, he's just a lazy little L.A. shit.
No,
Turner said, getting up from his seat on the ledge.
He's right. If he sprained his wrist, we'd be screwed. Even something so minor that he couldn't feel it could affect his speed.
Weber shrugged.
Yeah? Well, he's back in the bunker, bathing his hands in the last of our water, and humming to himself. So we should be just fine.
When they reached the surgery, Turner automatically counted heads. 7. Ramirez was in the bunker. Sutcliffe was somewhere in the cinder block maze, monitoring the sentry remotes. Lynch had a Steiner optic laser slung over his right shoulder, a compact model with a folding alloy skeleton stock, integral batteries forming a fat hand grip below the gray titanium housing that served the thing as a barrel. Nathan was wearing a black jumpsuit, black paratrooper boots filmed with pale dust, and had the bulbous anti goggles of an image amplification rig dangling below his chin on a head strap. Turner removed his Mexican sunglasses, tucked them into a breast pocket in the blue work shirt, and buttoned the flap.
How's it going, Teddy?
He asked a beefy 6-footer with close-cropped brown hair.
Just fine, Teddy said with a toothy smile.
Turner surveyed the other 3 members of the psych team, nodding to each man in turn, Compton, Costa, Davis.
Getting down to the wire, huh?
Costa asked. He had a round, moist face and a thin, carefully trimmed beard. Like Nathan and the others, he wore black.
Pretty close, Turner said. All smooth so far.
Costa nodded.
We're an estimated 30 minutes from arrival, Turner said.
Nathan Davis, Weber said. Disconnect the sewage line.
She handed Turner one of the Telefunken earbead sets. She'd already removed it from its bubble pack. She put one on herself, peeling the plastic backing from the self-adhesive throat microphone and smoothing it into place on her sunburnt neck. Nathan and Davis were moving in the shadows behind the module. Turner heard Davis curse softly.
"Shit," Nathan said. "There's no cap for the end of the tube."
The others laughed. "Leave it," Weber said. "Get to work on the wheels. Lynch and Compton, unlimber the jacks." Lynch drew a pistol-shaped power driver from his belt and ducked beneath Surgery. It was swaying now, the suspension creaking softly. The medics were moving inside. Turner heard a brief, high-pitched whine from some piece of internal machinery, and then the chatter of Lynch's driver as he readied the jacks. He put his ear bead in and stuck the throat mic beside his larynx.
"Sutcliffe, check."
"Fine," the Australian said, a tiny voice that seemed to come from the base of his skull. "Ramirez,
loud and clear."
8 minutes. They were rolling the module out on its 10 fat tires. Turner and Nathan were on the front pair, steering. Nathan had his goggles on. Mitchell was coming out in the dark of the moon. The module was heavy, absurdly heavy, and very nearly impossible to steer.
"Like balancing a truck on a couple of shopping carts," Nathan said to himself.
Turner's lower back was giving him trouble. It hadn't been quite right since New Delhi.
"Hold it,"
Weber said, from the third wheel on the left. "I'm stuck in a fucking rock." Turner released his wheel and straightened up. The bats were out in force tonight, flickering things against the bowl of desert starlight. There were bats in Mexico, in the jungle. Fruit bats that slept in the trees that overhung the sweet cluster where the SenseNet crew slept. Turner had climbed those trees, had strung the overhanging limbs with taut lengths of molecular monofilament, meters of invisible razor waiting for an unwary intruder. But Jane and the others had died anyway, blown away on a hillside in the mountains near Acapulco. Trouble with a labor union, someone said later, but nothing was ever determined, really. Other than the fact of the primitive claymore charge, its placement and the position from which it had been detonated. Turner had climbed the hill himself, his clothes filmed with blood, and seen the nest of crushed undergrowth where the killers had waited, the knife switch and the corroded automobile battery. He found the butts of hand-rolled cigarettes and the cap from a bottle of Bohemia beer, bright and new. The series had to be canceled, and the crisis management team did yeoman duty, arranging the removal of bodies and the repatriation of the surviving members of the cast and crew. Turner was on the last plane out, and after 8 scotches in the lounge of the Acapulco airport, he'd wandered blindly out into the central ticketing area and encountered a man named Bushell, an executive tech from SenseNet's Los Angeles complex. Bushell was pale beneath an L.A. tan, his seersucker suit limp with sweat. He was carrying a plain aluminum case, like a camera case, its sides dull with condensation. Turner stared at the man, stared at the sweating case, with its red and white warning decals and lengthy labels explaining the precautions required in the transportation of materials in cryogenic storage.
"Christ,"
Bushell said, noticing him.
"Turner, I'm sorry, man. Came down this morning. Ugly fucking business."
He took a sodden handkerchief from his jacket pocket and wiped his face.
"Ugly job. I've never had to do one of these before."
"What's in the case, Bushell?" He was much closer now, although he didn't remember stepping forward. He could see the pores in Bushell's tanned face.
"You okay, man?"
Bushell, taking a step back.
"You look bad."
What's in the case, Bushel? Seersucker bunched in his fist, knuckles white and shaking.
Damn it, Turner!
The man jerking free. The handle of the case clutched in both hands now.
They weren't damaged. Only some minor abrasion on one of the corneas. They belonged to the net. It was in her contract, Turner.
And he turned away. His guts knotted tight around 8 glasses of straight scotch and fought the nausea. And he'd continued to fight it, held it off for 9 years, until, in his flight from the Dutchman, all the memory of it had come down on him, had fallen on him in London, in Heathrow, and he'd leaned forward, without pausing in his progress down yet another corridor, and vomited into a blue plastic waste canister.
Come on, Turner, Weber said. Put some back in it. Show us how it's done.
The module began to strain forward again through the tarry smell of the desert plants.
Ready here,
Ramirez said, his voice remote and calm.
Turner touched the throat mic.
I'm sending you some company. He removed his finger from the mic. Nathan, it's time. You and Davis, back to the bunker. Davis was in charge of the squirt gear, their sole non-matrix link with Hosaka. Nathan was Mr. Fix-It. Lynch was rolling the last of the bicycle wheels away into the brush beyond the parking lot. Weber and Compton were kneeling beside the module, attaching the line that linked the Hosaka surgeons with the Sony biomonitor in the command post. With the wheels removed, lowered and leveled on 4 jacks, the portable neurosurgery reminded Turner once again of the French vacation module. That had been a much later trip, 4 years after Conroy had recruited him in Los Angeles.
How's it going?
Sutcliffe asked over the link.
Fine.
Turner said, touching the mic.
Lonely out here,
Sutcliffe said.
Compton,
Turner said.
Sutcliffe needs you to help him cover the perimeter.
You too, Lynch.
Too bad,
Lynch said from the dark.
I was hoping I'd get to see the action.
Turner's hand was on the grip of the holstered Smith & Wesson under the open flap of the parka.
Now, Lynch.
If Lynch was Connie's plant, he'd want to be here. Or in the bunker.
Fuck it,
Lynch said.
There's nobody out there and you know it. You don't want me here. I'll go in there and watch Ramirez.
Right, Turner said and drew the gun, depressing the stud that activated the xenon projector. The first tight beam flash of noon-bright xenon light found a twisted saguaro, its needles like tufts of gray fur in the pitiless illumination. The second lit up the spiked skull of Lynch's belt, framed it in a sharp-edged circle. The sound of the shot and the sound of the bullet detonating on impact were indistinguishable. Waves of concussion rolling out in invisible, ever-widening rings out into the flat, dark land like thunder. In the first few seconds after, there was no sound at all. Even the bats and bugs silenced, waiting. Weber had thrown herself flat in the scrub, and somehow he sensed her there, now, knew that her gun would be out, held dead steady in those brown, capable hands. He had no idea where Compton was. Then, Sutcliffe's voice, over the earbead, scratching at him from his brain pan.
Tana, what was that?
There was enough starlight now to make out Weber. She was sitting up, gun in her hands, ready, her elbows braced on her knees.
It was Conroy's plant,
Turner said, lowering the Smith & Wesson.
Jesus Christ,
she said. I'm Conroy's plant.
He had a line out. I've seen it before.
She had to say it twice.
Sutcliffe's voice in his head, and then Ramirez.
We got your transportation. 80 clicks in closing. Everything else looks clear. There's a blimp 20 clicks south-southwest. Jaylene says, unmanned cargo, and it's right on schedule. Nothing else.
What the fuck's Sut yelling about? Nathan says he heard a shot.
Ramirez was jacked in, most of his sensorium taken up with the input from the Mas Neotech deck.
Nathan's ready with the first squirt.
Turner could hear the jet banking now, braking for the landing on the highway. Weber was up and walking toward him, her gun in her hand. Sutcliffe was asking the same question over and over. He reached up and touched the throat mic.
Lynch. He's dead. The jet's here. This is it. And then the jet was on them. Black shadow, incredibly low, coming in without lights. There was a flare of blowback jets as a thing executed a landing that would have killed a human pilot, and then a weird creaking as it readjusted its articulated carbon fiber airframe. Turner could make out the green reflected glow of instrumentation in the curve of the plastic canopy.
You fucked up,
Weber said.
Behind her, the hatch in the side of the surgery module popped open, framing a masked figure in a green paper contamination suit. The light from inside was blue-white, brilliant. It threw a distorted shadow of the suited medic out through the thin cloud of dust that hung above the lot in the wake of the jet's landing.
Close it! Weber shouted. Not yet!
As the door swung down, shutting out the light, they both heard the ultralight's engine. After the roar of the jet, it seemed no more than the hum of a dragonfly, a drone that stuttered and faded as they listened.
He's out of fuel, Weber said. But he's close.
He's here, Turner said, pressing the throat mic. First squirt.
The tiny plane whispered past them, a dark delta against the stars. They could hear something flapping in the wind of its silent passage. Perhaps one of Mitchell's pants legs.
You're up there, Turner thought. All alone in the warmest clothes you own, wearing a pair of infrared goggles you built for yourself, and you're looking for a pair of dotted lines picked out for you in hand warmers. You crazy fucker, he said, his heart filling with a strange admiration. You really want it out bad.
Then the first flare went up, with a festive little pop, and the magnesium glare began its slow white parachute ride to the desert floor. Almost immediately there were two more, and the long rattle of automatic fire from the west end of the mall. He was peripherally aware of Weber stumbling through the brush, in the direction of the bunker, but his eyes were fixed on the wheeling ultralight, on its gay orange and blue fabric wings, and the goggled figure hunched there in the open metal framework above the fragile tripod landing gear.
Mitchell.
The lot was bright as a football field under the drifting flares. The ultralight banked and turned with a lazy grace that made Turner want to scream. A line of tracers hosed out in a wide arc from beyond the sight perimeter. Missed. Get it down. Get it down. He was running, jumping clumps of brush that caught at his ankles, at the hem of his parka. The flares. The light. Mitchell couldn't use the goggles now, couldn't see the infrared glow of the hand warmers. He was bringing it in, wide of the strip. The nose wheel caught in something, and the ultralight cartwheeled, crumpling, torn butterfly, and then lay down in its own white cloud of dust. The flash of the explosion seemed to reach him in an instant before the sound, throwing his shadow before him across the pale brush. The concussion picked him up and threw him down, and as he fell, he saw the broken surgery module in a ball of yellow flame and knew that Weber had used her anti-tank rocket. Then he was up again, moving, running, the gun in his hand. He reached the wreckage of Mitchell's ultralight as the first flare died. Another one arced out of nowhere and blossomed overhead. The sound of firing was continuous now. He scrambled over a twisted sheet of rusted tin and found the sprawled figure of the pilot, head and face concealed by a makeshift helmet and a clumsy-looking goggle rig. The goggles were fastened to the helmet with dull silver strips of gaffer tape. The twisted limbs were padded in layers of dark clothing. Turner watched his hands claw at the tape, tear at the infrared goggles. His hands were distant creatures, pale undersea things that lived a life of their own far down at the bottom of some unthinkable Pacific trench. And he watched as they tore frantically at tape, goggles, helmet, until it all came away, and the long brown hair, limp with sweat, fell across the girl's white face, smearing the thin trickle of dark blood that ran from one nostril. And her eyes opened, revealing empty whites. And he was tugging her up somehow into a fireman's carry and reeling in what he hoped was the direction of the jet. He felt the second explosion through the soles of his deck shoes and saw the idiot grin on the lump of plastique that sat on Ramirez's cyberspace deck. There was no flash, only sound and the sting of concussion through the concrete of the lot. And then he was in the cockpit, breathing the new car smell of long-chain monomers, the familiar scent of newly minted technology, and the girl was behind him, an awkward doll sprawled in the embrace of the G-web that Conroy had paid a San Diego arms dealer to install behind the pilot's web. The plane was quivering, a live thing. And as he squirmed deeper into his own web, he fumbled for the interface cable, found it, ripped the Microsoft from his socket, and slid the cable jack home. Knowledge lit him like an arcade game, and he surged forward with the plainness of the jet, feeling the flexible airframe reshape itself for jump-off as the canopy whined smoothly down on its servos. The G-web ballooned around him, locking his limbs rigid, the gun still in his hand. Go, motherfucker. But the jet already knew, and G-force crushed him down into the dark. You lost consciousness, the plane said. Its chip voice sounded vaguely like Conroy. How long? 38 seconds. Where are we? Over Nagos. The head-up display lit. A dozen constantly altered figures beneath a simplified map of the Arizona-Sonora line. The sky went white. What was that? Silence. What was that? Sensors indicate an explosion, the plane said. The magnitude suggests a tactical nuclear warhead. But there was no electromagnetic pulse. The locus of destruction was our point of departure. The white glow faded and was gone. Cancel course, he said. Canceled? New headings, please. That's a good question, Turner said. He couldn't turn his head to look at the girl behind him. He wondered if she were dead yet.
Chapter 15 Box. Marley dreamed of Alan, dusk in a wildflower field, and he cradled her head, then caressed and broke her neck. Lay there unmoving, but she knew what he was doing. He kissed her all over. He took her money and the keys to her room. The stars were huge now, fixed above the bright fields, and she could still feel his hands on her neck. She woke in the coffee-scented morning and saw the squares of sunlight spread across the books on Andrea's table. Heard Andrea's comfortingly familiar morning cough as she lit a first cigarette from the stove's front burner. She shook off the dark colors of the dream and sat up on Andrea's couch, hugging the dark red quilt around her knees. After Nas, after the police and the reporters, she'd never dreamed of him. Or if she did, she'd guessed she somehow censored the dreams, erased them before she woke. She shivered, although it was already a warm morning, and went into the bathroom. She wanted no more dreams of Alan. Paco told me that Alan was armed when we met, she said when Andrea handed her the blue enamel mug of coffee. Alan armed? Andrea divided the omelet and slid half onto Marley's plate. What a bizarre idea. It would be like arming a penguin. They both laughed. Alan is not the type, Andrea said. He'd shoot his foot off in the middle of some passionate declaration about the state of art and the amount of the dinner bill. He's a big shit, Alan, but that's hardly news. If I were you, I'd expend a bit more worry on this Paco. What reason do you have for accepting that he works for Virek? She took a bite of omelet and reached for the salt. I saw him. He was there in Virek's construct. You saw something. An image only, the image of a child which only resembled this man. Marley watched Andrea eat her half of the omelet, letting her own grow cold on the plate. How could she explain about the scent she'd had walking from the Louvre? The conviction that something surrounded her now, monitoring her with relaxed precision, that she had become the focus of at least a part of Virek's empire. He's a very wealthy man, she began. Virek? Andrea put her knife and fork down on the plate and took up her coffee. I should say he is. If you believe the journalists, he's the single wealthiest individual, period. As rich as some Zaibatsu. But there's the catch, really. Is he an individual? In the sense that you are or I am? No. Aren't you going to eat that? Marley began to mechanically cut and fork sections of the cooling omelet, while Andrea continued. You should look at the manuscript we're working on this month. Marley chewed, raised her eyebrows questioningly. It's a history of the high-orbit industrial clans. A man at the University of Nice did it. Your Virek's even in it, come to think. He cited as a counterexample, or rather as a type of parallel evolution. This fellow at Nice is interested in the paradox of individual wealth in a corporate age, in why it should still exist at all. Great wealth, I mean. He sees the high-orbit clans, people like the Tessier-Ashpools, as a very late variant on traditional patterns of aristocracy. Late because the corporate mode doesn't really allow for an aristocracy. She put her cup down on her plate and carried the plate to the sink. Actually, now that I've started to describe it, it isn't that interesting. There's a great deal of very gray prose about the nature of mass man. With caps, mass man. He's big on caps, not much of a stylist. She spun the taps and water hissed out through the filtration unit. But what does he say about Virek? He says, if I remember all this correctly, and I'm not at all certain that I do, that Virek is an even greater fluke than the industrial clans in orbit. The clans are transgenerational, and there is usually a fair bit of medicine involved. Cryogenics, genetic manipulation, various ways to combat aging. The death of a given clan member, even a founding member, usually wouldn't bring the clan, as a business entity, to a crisis point. There's always someone to step in, someone waiting. The difference between a clan and a corporation, however, is that you don't need to literally marry into a corporation. But they sign indentures. Andrea shrugged. That's like a lease. It isn't the same thing. It's job security, really. But when your Herr Virek dies, finally, when they run out of room to enlarge his vat, whatever, his business interests will lack a logical focus. At that point, our man in Nice has it, you'll see Virek and company either fragment or mutate. The latter giving us the something company and a true multinational. Yet another home for capital M Massman. She wiped her plate, rinsed it, dried it, and placed it in the pine rack beside the sink. He says that's too bad in a way because there are so few people left who can even see the edge. The edge? The edge of the crowd. We're lost in the middle, you and I. Or I still am, at any rate. She crossed the kitchen and put her hands on Marley's shoulders. You want to take care in this. A part of you is already much happier. But now I see that I could have brought that about myself, simply by arranging a little lunch for you with your pig of a former lover. The rest of it I'm not sure. I think our academics theory is invalidated by the obvious fact that Virek and his kind are already far from human. I want you to be careful. Then she kissed Marley's cheek and went off to her work as an assistant editor in the fashionably archaic business of printing books. She spent the morning at Andrea's with the Brown, viewing the holograms of the seven works. Each piece was extraordinary in its own way. But she repeatedly returned to the box Virek had shown her first. If I had the original here, she thought, and removed the glass, and one by one removed the objects inside, what would be left? Useless things. A frame of space. Perhaps a smell like dust. She sprawled on the couch, the Brown resting on her stomach, and stared into the box. It ached. It seemed to her that the construction evoked something perfectly, but it was an emotion that lacked a name. She ran her hands through the bright illusion, tracing the length of the fluted avian bone. She was certain that Virek had already assigned an ornithologist the task of identifying the bird from whose wing that bone had come, and it would be possible to date each object with the greatest precision, she supposed. Each tab of Palofiche also housed an extensive report on the known origin of each piece, but something in her had deliberately avoided these. It was sometimes best, when you came to the mystery that was art, to come as a child. The child saw things that were too evident, too obvious for the trained eye. She put the Brown down on the low table beside the couch and crossed to Andrea's phone, intending to check the time. She was meeting Paco at 1 to discuss the mechanics of Alan's payment. Alan had told her he would phone her at Andrea's at 3. When she punched for the time service, an automatic recap of satellite news strobed across the screen. A JAL shuttle had disintegrated during re-entry over the Indian Ocean. Investigators from the Boston-Atlanta Metropolitan Axis had been called in to examine the site of a brutal and apparently pointless bombing in a drab New Jersey residential suburb.
Militiamen were supervising the evacuation of the southern quadrant of New Bonn, following the discovery by construction workers of two undetonated wartime rockets, believed to be armed with biological weapons. And official sources in Arizona were denying Mexico's accusation of the detonation of a small-scale atomic or nuclear device near the Sonora border. As she watched, the recap cycled, and the simulation of the shuttle began its fire death again. She shook her head, tapping the button. It was noon. Summer had come, the sky hot and blue above Paris, and she smiled at the smell of good bread and black tobacco. Her sense of being observed had receded now, as she walked from the metro to the address Paco had given her. Faubourg Saint-Honoré. The address seemed vaguely familiar. A gallery, she thought. Yes. The Roberts. The owner, an American, who operated three galleries in New York as well. Expensive, but no longer quite chic. Paco was waiting beside an enormous panel on which were layered, beneath a thick and uneven coat of varnish, hundreds of small square photographs, the kind produced by certain very old-fashioned machines in train stations and bus terminals. All of them seemed to be of young girls. Automatically, she noted the name of the artist and the work's title. Read us the Book of the Names of the Dead.
I suppose you understand this sort of thing,
the Spaniard said glumly. He wore an expensive-looking blue suit, cut in Parisian business style, a white broadcloth shirt, and a very English-looking tie, probably from Charvet. He didn't look at all like a waiter now. There was an Italian bag of black-ribbed rubber slung over his shoulder.
What do you mean?
She asked.
Names of the dead.
And he nodded in the direction of the panel.
You are a dealer in these things.
What don't you understand?
I sometimes feel as though this culture is entirely a trick, a ruse. All my life I have served Señor in one guise or another, you understand? And my work has not been without its satisfactions, moments of triumph. But never, when he involved me with this business of art, have I felt any satisfaction. He is wealth itself. The world is filled with objects of great beauty. And yet, Señor pursues.
He shrugged. You know what you like, then? She smiled at him.
Why did you choose this gallery for our meeting?
Señor's agent purchased one of the boxes here. Haven't you read the histories we provided you with in Brussels?
No, she said. It might interfere with my intuition. Herr Viereck is paying me for my intuition.
He raised his eyebrows.
I will introduce you to Picard, the manager. Perhaps he can do something for this intuition of yours.
He led her across the room and through a doorway. A graying, heavy-set Frenchman in a rumpled corduroy suit was speaking into the handset of a phone. On the phone screen, she saw columns of letters and figures, the day's quotations on the New York market.
Ah,
the man said.
Hesteris, excuse me, only a moment.
He smiled apologetically and returned to his conversation. Marley studied the quotations. Pollock was down again. This, she supposed, was the aspect of art that she had the most difficulty understanding. Picard, if that was the man's name, was speaking with a broker in New York, arranging the purchase of a certain number of points of the work of a particular artist. A point might be defined in any number of ways, depending on the medium involved. But it was almost certain that Picard would never see the works he was purchasing. If the artist enjoyed sufficient status, the originals were very likely crated away in some vault, where no one saw them at all.
days or years later, Picard might pick up that same phone and order the broker to sell. Marley's gallery had sold originals. There was relatively little money in it, but it had a certain visceral appeal. And of course there had been the chance that one would get lucky. She had convinced herself that she'd gotten very lucky indeed when Alan had arranged for the forged Cornell to surface as a wonderful accidental find. Cornell had his place on the broker's board, and his points were very expensive. "Picard," Paco said, as though he were addressing a servant. "This is Marley Khrushcheva. Señor has brought her into the matter of the anonymous boxes. She may wish to ask you questions."
"Charmed,"
Picard said and smiled warmly, but she thought she detected a flicker in his brown eyes. Very likely he was trying to connect the name to some scandal, relatively recent.
"I understand that your gallery handled the transaction then."
"Yes,"
Picard said.
"We had displayed the work in our New York rooms, and it had attracted a number of bids. We decided to give it its day in Paris, however."
He beamed.
"And your employer made our decision most worthwhile. How is Herr Virek Esteves? We have not seen him in several weeks."
Marley glanced quickly at Paco, but his dark face was smooth, utterly controlled. "Señor is very well, I would think," he said.
"Excellent,"
said Picard, somewhat too enthusiastically. He turned to Marley.
"A marvelous man. A legend. A great patron. A great scholar."
Marley thought she heard Paco sigh.
"Could you tell me, please, where your New York branch obtained the work in question?"
Picard's face fell. He looked at Paco, then back at Marley.
"You don't know? They haven't told you?"
"Could you tell me, please?"
"No,"
Picard said.
"I'm sorry, but I can't. You see, we don't know."
Marley stared at him.
"I beg your pardon, but I don't quite see how that is possible."
"She hasn't read the report, Picard. You tell her. It will be good for her intuition to hear it from your own lips." Picard gave Paco an odd look, then regained his composure.
"Certainly,"
he said.
"A pleasure."
"Do you think it's true?"
she asked Paco, as they stepped out into Faubourg Saint-Honoré and summer sunlight. The crowds were thick with Japanese tourists.
"I went to the sprawl myself," Paco said, "and interviewed everyone involved. Roberts left no record of the purchase, although ordinarily he was no more secretive than the next art dealer."
"And his death was accidental?"
He put on a pair of mirrored Porsche glasses.
"As accidental as that sort of death ever is," he said. "We have no way of knowing when or how he obtained the piece. We located it here 8 months ago, and all our attempts to work backward end with Roberts. And Roberts has been dead for a year. Picard neglected to tell you that they very nearly lost the thing. Roberts kept it in his country house, along with a number of other things that his survivors regarded as mere curiosities. The whole lot came close to being sold at public auction. Sometimes I wish it had been."
"These other things," she asked, falling into step beside him, "what are they?"
He smiled.
"You think we haven't tracked them, each one? We have. They were..."
Here he frowned, exaggerating the effort of memory.
"A number of rather unremarkable examples of contemporary folk art. Was Roberts known to be interested in that sort of thing?
No, he said. But approximately a year before his death, we know that he made application for membership in the Institut de l'Art Brut, here in Paris.